Trefin Maurice hissed, pulling up his hood and tightening the folds. But Rue knew it was too late for any sort of disguise. Stepping silently to one side of the entry, as the steps approached, she waited for the door to open and the gnome hunter to step through, then brought the haft of the knife around in a powerful blow that caught the gnome on his temple and dropped him like a stone. "Help me," she said, kicking the door closed and taking the gnome's arms. Together, they hauled the body to one of the closets, bound his arms and legs, gagged his mouth, and stuffed him inside. Without another word, or more than a quick glance at each other, they went out through the door the gnome had entered and down the corridor beyond, Trefin Maurice leading the way. One corridor intersected with another. One set of stairs wound to a second, doors opened and closed into rooms, and so they made their way through the shadowy halls, pausing only to listen for voices or footsteps as they went. The minutes slipped away, and Rue was quickly lost. She didn't know that much about Paranor anyway, having visited only a handful of times, and having never ventured much beyond the main halls that led to the council chambers and the rooms of the Ard Ris. They were deep underground here, in a maze of passageways she had never seen and could never have navigated on her own. She could feel the cold permeating the rock. Even the central fires of the keep's furnace, the fires that burned from deep underground at the earth's core, could not push back the chill. Once or twice, Trefin Maurice glanced back, and each time she nodded quickly for him to go on. She was thinking of Beck, just out of reach. But she was thinking about Penderyn as well, much farther away, and more vulnerable. She was thinking about her child, and how she would never be able to live with herself if something were to happen to him. Finally, Trefin Maurice slowed, then stopped altogether, dropping into a crouch beneath the light of a torch burning in its wall bracket. Ahead, a door stood closed to whatever lay beyond. "A pair of guards keeps watch there," he whispered as she crouched next to him. "We have to silence them both. Beyond that room, stairs lead downward to a corridor of cells. Your husband is in one of them. A second pair of gnome hunters stands watch there, one at the bottom of the stairs, another in front of the cell that imprisons your husband. Any sort of warning will result in a swift response." She nodded. "There won't be any warning. I was able to get another note to your husband several days ago, so that he would know that someone was looking to help him. He will know we are coming, and he will be ready, even if the gnome hunter at his cell door attempts to kill him. I don't know a great deal about his magic, but I gather it was a match for his sister's, so he will have a chance to survive this." He sighed. "I wish I could have done more." She gave him a quick smile. "You have done all that could be expected of you, Trefin Maurice. However this turns out, you can't be faulted for your efforts." He took her arm as she started to rise. "Wait." He seemed suddenly nervous. "I have to tell you something. I am not a warrior druid. I am not skilled in the use of weapons or magic as a substitute for weapons. I have magic, yes, but my studies are of rocks and soils." She stared at him. "Rocks and soils?" He nodded. "I have never killed anyone." He dropped his gaze. "I have never even hurt anyone. I don't know how to fight." She took a deep breath. She had fought alone before and against great odds, but she had been much younger then, harder and more resilient, reckless about her safety in a way she no longer was. Not with the lives of her husband and son at stake, as well as her own. She wished suddenly that her brother were there, that Redden Altmer were standing with her, as he had on so many other occasions. Having Big Red with her would change the odds considerably. But she might just as well wish she could fly. "You won't have to fight," she told Trefin Maurice, reaching out to grip his arm reassuringly. She saw some of the tension drain from his young face. Stay behind me, and do what you can to protect yourself if you are threatened. I will dispose of the guards." Her grip tightened. "One thing you must promise me, though. If I fall, wounded or dead, you must continue on. You must do whatever you can to reach Beck. You must free him, and then tell him what you have told me. He will know what to do. Will you do that?" Trefin Maurice nodded. "You have my word." She looked down at the long knife she had taken from the gnome hunter and wished she had something more substantial with which to work. It had been 20 years since she had fought a battle like the one she was facing, and she knew she had lost the sharp edge of her survival instincts. Could she do this? A fierce resolution washed over her as she hefted the knife in her palm, watching the way the torchlight played across its polished surface. Some things you did because you had to. "All right," she said, looking up at him. "I'm ready." In a guarded crouch, they began to creep down the hall. Chapter 5. Rue Meridian was leading the way, Trefin Maurice hanging back. She reached the door to the guard room, hesitated, glanced down at the latch, then back at the young druid. He saw her questioning look, and he nodded, motioning her to go ahead, indicating the door was not locked. She wasn't sure how he could know that, but had to believe him. Taking a deep breath, she placed her hand over the heavy iron handle, twisted hard, and pushed. Two gnome hunters looked up as she entered. One was at work on the broken handle of a short sword. The second stood across the room, leaning idly against the wall. Both hesitated, confused by the presence of the druid behind her. She had just enough time to register the open door across the room, and then the gnome leaning against the wall made up his mind about her and reached for a pike. Flinging the long knife underhanded with such force that the blade was buried in his chest all the way up to the hilt, she killed him before his hand could close on the pike's wooden shaft. The gnome gave a sharp gasp and sank slowly down, hands clutching at the haft of the knife. By then, she was across the room and on top of the other one. He awkwardly struck at her with the broken sword, but she caught the flat of the blade on her forearms and knocked it aside. She jammed her fingers into his throat, silencing his voice, and then struck him repeatedly on the side of his head with her fist. His eyes rolled back, and he collapsed and lay still. Neither gnome was moving. She found no pulse on either. She snatched a pair of daggers from a rack and stuck them in her belt, hesitated, then added a long knife. She turned to an ashen-faced Trefin Maurice, who clearly hadn't exaggerated when he said he wasn't a fighter. She placed a warning finger to her lips and moved close. "Are you all right?" she whispered. He nodded, his eyes big. "Listen, then. I want you to go down the stairs ahead of me. The gnomes won't react so quickly to the sight of a druid. They will think Shadea or one of her allies sent you. When you reach the first, get him turned around so that his back is to me. Can you do that?" He nodded again, breathing hard through his mouth. "Don't worry," she said. "We'll be all right." She steered him toward the open door across the room. Beyond, a set of narrow stairs spiraled downward into near darkness. She had to hope that no sound of the struggle that had just taken place had reached the ears of the guards below. It had been quick enough. There had been no cries of alarm. She paused at the top of the stairs and listened, carefully. Nothing. She nodded to Trefin Maurice and motioned him ahead. He moved reluctantly, woodenly, and she seized his shoulder to make certain he wasn't going into shock. He gasped in pain and glanced quickly at her, then took a deep breath and nodded that he was ready. She released him with a gentle shove and watched him start down. She waited until he was out of sight around the bend in the stairs, then followed, creeping on cat's paws along the rough expanse of the curved wall, one of the daggers out and resting loosely in her hand. Halfway there, she thought. But the second pair might pose more of a challenge. She would have to silence them, one at a time, and that wouldn't be easy. Beck might be ready, or he might not. But the suddenness of a rescue like this one could throw your thinking off, no matter how formidable your skills. Beck was brave, but he did not have her experience at close combat. Though he had grown considerably during their journey to Parcasia, that had been 20 years ago, and she was willing to bet that he had already forgotten much of what he had learned. Nor had he practiced with the wish song in the intervening years. He had disdained to use it, preferring to leave that part of his life behind him. In spite of her own dislike and mistrust of the magic, she wished he had not been so insistent on ignoring his gift. Well, that was the way of things, she supposed. Hindsight always suggested how you might have been better prepared. She edged forward as the light grew slightly stronger near the bottom of the steps. Ahead, she heard Trefin Morris's voice and the responding growl of the gnome hunter on watch. She slid around the curve in the wall so that she could see them. The gnome had his back to her. So far, so good. She came up behind him swiftly and killed him with a single thrust of the dagger, at which point Trefin Morris threw up. The retching sound reverberated down the corridor and instantly brought a sharp query from the near darkness. Leaping past the young druid, Rue raced ahead, sliding free the other dagger as she ran, no longer bothering with stealth. Speed was all that mattered. Ahead, there was a movement at the edge of the light, and she saw the final guard peering at her through the smoky, torch-lit gloom, crossbow at the ready. She threw herself flat as the weapon swung up and heard the whirr of the bolt as it shot past her, ricocheted off the stone walls, and fell harmlessly to the floor further on. She was up and running again, watching her adversary wind back the string and insert another bolt with quick, practiced movements. This one was well-trained. Dangerous. The crossbow came up, and she threw herself down a second time, but this time the gnome did not fire at her. Instead, as soon as she was down, he wheeled toward the cell door in front of him, grappling to release the heavy locking bolt. Rue was on her feet, instantly, realizing at once what he intended. His orders in this situation were clear. She heard the locking bolt slide free, and the cell door swing open. The guard brought up the crossbow a second time. She was still too far away to stop him, so she screamed at him, then hurtled the dagger as hard as she could. There wasn't enough force behind the throw to injure him, but the heavy blade ripped through his leather tunic, causing him to jerk back. Then Beck Ohmsford was hurtling through the open cell door and slamming into the gnome. The crossbow released. The bolt flew into the ceiling and dropped harmlessly. The Southlander and the gnome went down in a heap, tumbling across the floor, arms and legs entangled. Rue put on a burst of speed, drawing the long knife from her belt. Ahead of her, the flat surface of a blade caught the light as it swept down. Someone cried out, and then she was on top of the fighters, screaming in rage, burying her own blade deep into the gnome hunter's back, driving it all the way through him. The gnome hunter fell away, dead before his hands released their grip. Rue threw the body aside and knelt next to her husband, already seeing the red stains spreading across his tunic front. "No!" she hissed, and began trying to sort through the tangle of his clothes for the wound. "Stop it, Rue." He pushed her hands away, shaking his head. There was pain and frustration in his voice. "There's no time. We have to get out of here." He was already struggling to his feet, clutching his midsection. "I'm all right. He only scraped my ribs." "It's more than that," she snapped back. "Look at the blood." Trefin Maurice came pounding up, his black robes flying out behind him. He looked at Beck and turned white. "How bad is it?" Beck shook his head. "Not now. Which way out? Can you get us to Swift Shore?" The young druid nodded. "Bellazin should already be there. She will have secured it for us. Can you walk?" Rue was tearing her robe into long strips, using the dagger to cut the fabric. Without comment, she began wrapping it tightly about Beck's midsection. He leaned into her and whispered as she did so, "I love you." Then they were running, all three of them, back down the corridor past the dead men and fallen weapons, past the blood and vomit, and up the stairs, gaining the guardroom and the corridors beyond. It was still quiet in the keep. No warning yet raised. No alarm given. Then Trefin Maurice took them a different way, using a series of narrow back stairways to gain the higher floors. Rue tried to help Beck, who was beginning to falter. His blood speckled the floor behind him as he ran. They were still in great danger, their escape reliant on reaching Swift Shore before the rest of the gnome guards discovered their comrades. Or they had the misfortune of stumbling across someone who would give them away, which was exactly what happened. They had just reached the upper levels, where tall windows opened to hazy gray light and heavy clouds, when a lone gnome hunter came out of a room right next to them. Everyone froze for an instant, and then the gnome was crying out. Rue buried her dagger in his chest, knocking him back into the room. But the damage had been done. The cry was immediately taken up, and the pursuit they had feared was mobilizing. They began to run again, Beck's arm about Rue's shoulders, her arm about his waist. She felt the thick dampness of his blood seeping into her own clothing. "It's not far," Trefin Maurice called back to them, leading the way. "Just ahead, through those doors." A pair of heavy, iron-bound oak doors stood closed at the end of the corridor, but the sound of boots reverberated on the stone flooring from just out of sight behind the fugitives. "We're not going to make it," Rue thought. Gnome hunters burst into view, rounding a corner of the hallway perhaps 100 feet back, too many to stand and face, too many to overcome with conventional weapons. Rue glanced at Beck. His eyes were slits in a face gone pale and sweaty. His breathing was shallow and ragged. He was failing rapidly and in no position to use his magic. Then they were at the double doors, and Trefin Maurice was wrenching them open. Rue and Beck stumbled through, and the young druid shoved the doors closed behind them and stepped back. "Wait!" He mumbled something, his hands weaving. The locks on the doors melted and fused into a knot of iron, sealed shut. He turned back to them and grinned triumphantly. "I know a little magic." They were in the airship courtyard, and Swift Shore hovered just off the ground not 100 yards ahead, straining at her anchor ropes, her light sheaths rippling in the breeze, and her radiant draws taut. She was rigged for flying and ready to lift off. From the pilot box, a solitary figure dressed in black druid robes jumped up and started waving. "Bellazin!" Trefin Maurice shouted. The girl shouted back, then darted out of the box and down to the decking. A moment later, one end of a rope ladder flew over the side. But in the same instant, a clutch of gnome hunters appeared on the keep's battlements behind them. They howled in anger when they saw what was happening. Still supporting a wounded Beck, Rue lurched toward the safety of the airship. Trefin Maurice darted ahead. Then, seeing how badly his companions were struggling, he raced back to help, taking Beck's other arm and slinging it over his shoulder. "Hurry!" he urged. Rue didn't need to be told. Arrows fired from gnome bows were falling all around them, sharpened heads clattering and skipping across the stones. Rue realized suddenly that she had no weapons of her own, that none of them had, that they had left everything behind in their battle to escape the cells. She glanced ahead at Swift Shore, caught sight of the starboard rail sling in place on the bow, and felt a flutter of hope. "Does Bellazin know how to use airship weapons?" she shouted at Trefin Maurice above the cry of the attacking guards. "Do you?" The young druid shook his head. "Neither of us does. We aren't trained in the use of weapons." A bad oversight, she thought. She took a deep breath. "Stay with Beck," she ordered. She dropped her husband's arm and sprinted for the airship ladder. She knew what she was doing. She was trying to save him, but she was also leaving him to his fate, abandoning him to the gnome hunters. He would never reach the airship if she failed. Both he and Trefin Maurice would die. But there wasn't any other way. A crossbow bolt caught her in the thigh, passing so deep into her flesh it jarred the bone. She cried out in pain, stumbled, righted herself, and hobbled on. Arrows rained down all about her, but she was only nicked, until one caught her in the shoulder and spun her all the way around. She continued to run, teeth clenched, hands knotted into fists. "Just a little farther." She leapt onto the rope ladder and clambered up the rungs in a wash of razor-edged pain and suffocating heat that took her breath away. She reached the top, and Bellazin grabbed her arm and pulled her past the railing and onto the deck. The druid girl was no older than Trefin Maurice, younger still, Rue guessed. Short-cropped blue-black hair formed a helmet about a face paler than Grianne Olmsford's. Eyes as black as pools on a moonless night peered over. "What do you need me to do?" Rue hesitated. Gnome missiles thudded into the airship decking, bristling from the planks and rails like quills. Impatient with the failure of their bowmen to bring her down, and infuriated by the efforts of Trefin Maurice, gnome hunters were rappelling down the keep's walls on ropes. The young druid had shown enough presence of mind to use his druid magic to cause clouds of dust to swirl across the courtyard, hiding Beck and himself. It was a clever strategy. But once those descending the walls reached the ground, the pair would be found again quickly enough. And the rail sling, with its slow-cranking winch and single bolt, wasn't going to be enough to stop them. "Help me into the pilot box," she said, struggling to stand. Bellazin was stronger than she looked, and she hauled Rue to her feet, practically carrying her across the deck and up the 3 steps into the pilot box. Fighting the waves of pain and nausea that threatened to undo her, Rue gripped the controls of the airship, unhooding the parse tubes to release the power stored in the diapson crystals and readying the thruster levers. "Cut the aft and forward anchor ropes," she ordered the girl. "Then drop flat against the deck close by the rope ladder, but leave the ladder down." Bellazin saw what she intended, jumped down the steps out of the box, and raced off to cut the ropes. Swift Shore was already straining against the lines, responding to the fresh power Rue was feeding her. In the courtyard, the haze of dust still obscured Beck and Trefin Maurice, but the gnome hunters who had repelled from the battlements were almost upon them. She shouted again at Bellazin, feeling the ship swing about as the aft anchor rope was cut, then lurch forward moments later as the bow anchor rope followed. Swift Shore shot forward, as if catapulted from a sling. Too much power! They would run Beck and the young druid down. Rue hauled back on the thruster levers, reversing the flow of power through the parse tubes. The airship bucked and slowed, and she was suddenly in the thick of the dust cloud, arrows and crossbow bolts flying everywhere as shouts rose from the gnomes charging across the courtyard. "Beck!" she screamed. The big airship swung about, clearing a space in the dust cloud, and she saw her husband and his rescuer almost underneath the hull. Bellazin was on her feet, calling down to them, directing them toward the ladder. They reached it in seconds and began to climb, Beck in the lead, Trefin Maurice helping to boost him up. But they were too slow, each step taking too long. Beck, weak from loss of blood and exhaustion, was barely hanging on. Frantic, Rue leaped from the pilot box onto the decking and charged forward to the rail sling. Cranking back the winch furiously, she inserted a bolt, swung the weapon about, and fired it into the clutch of gnome hunters just emerging from the haze. Three or four of them were knocked backwards like rag dolls. The rest, caught by surprise and not exactly sure what had just happened, dropped flat against the courtyard stones, trying to shield themselves. That gave Beck and Treffen Maurice just enough time to gain the airship railing where Bellazin was waiting to pull them aboard. Rue dropped the handle of the rail sling and raced back for the pilot box. Leaping inside, she threw the thrusters to the left parse tubes forward and yanked the thrusters to the right parse tubes all the way back. Swift Shure swung violently about, turning toward the outer walls and the dragon's teeth, and Rue shoved all the thruster levers forward and tilted the tube noses up to gain lift. An instant later, the airship exploded out of the courtyard and rose into midday sky, leaving Paranor with its druids and gnome hunters and dark memories behind. Chapter 6. Dawn broke on the Preken Doran, a brilliant flare of golden light sweeping out of the eastern horizon down the twisting, broken maze of ridges and gullies where Pied Sandaling crouched. The sky was a cloudless canopy of brightening blue, the air still and cool, the light knife-sharp, etching the contours and folds of the land. It was a day created for the witnessing of great things. The Federation Army, a steady wave of silver and black visible through gaps in the shadow-dappled draw, approached like a winding snake toward the rise where the elves waited. The scrape of their boots against the hard pan and the clash of metal armor and weapons signaled their arrival long before they came into view. In 2 days of steady marching, they had encountered only remnants of the force that had withstood their efforts to gain the heights for almost 30 years. Clearly, they felt they would encounter no meaningful opposition now that they had broken the back of the elven army. Maybe they will pay for their arrogance and overconfidence before the day is over, Pied thought. Or maybe such arrogance was justified, and he was the one who should take better stock of the situation. What reason did he have to think his ragtag force of elves could defeat an army of regulars? Yet he knew that the elves were determined, driven by rage at the losses they had suffered and by a humiliating sense of impotence at having been made to flee like cattle. Drum, he called quietly to his aide. Drummondoon scooted over, staying low on the crest of the rise to keep hidden, his young face intense. Captain? What is this place called? Unable to answer, Drum shook his head. He crab-walked away, speaking to a handful of elven hunters before coming back again. It doesn't have a name. There's never been a reason to give it one. Indeed, Pied thought. Look at it. A barren wasteland in which no one would want to live. A nature-ravaged stretch of earth which humans and animals passed through quickly on their way to somewhere more inviting. But it needed a name. His sense of his own mortality was strong that morning, and if he was to die there, he wanted to do so knowing where it happened. We will call it Elven Rock, he said. He gripped Drum by his shoulder. It is here that the elves became a rock against which all enemies are smashed. Pass the word. Drum gave him a strange look, then turned and hurried off to do as he had been ordered. Pied watched him go, watched him stop and speak with groups of soldiers as he worked his way down the line, watched some of those soldiers nod in agreement, watched fresh determination etch their brows. They would fight hard, those men and women. They would not break easily. Within the draw, the sounds of the Federation's approach deepened. The army was almost through. In moments, it would begin to emerge onto the flats leading up to the rise and the elves. Pied took a final look around at the defenses he had set, taking their measure one last time. He could see nothing of the elven bowmen hidden in the rocks and crevices in the heights to either side, where the draw opened onto the flats. There were more than 200, and they would have an unobstructed view of the Federation soldiers as they emerged from the shadows. Longbows were the order of the day, the favorite weapon of elven bowmen who disdained use of the bulkier, heavier crossbows. Eris Kruer, a third lieutenant, the highest-ranking officer left among them, commanded. From his slightly higher vantage point, Pied caught glimpses of the elven hunters hidden in the deep folds of the ravines to his right. Almost a quarter of his little army was concealed there, waiting for the summons that would bring it into battle on the Federation's left flank. The timing of that strike would determine the outcome of the battle. The soldier who was to call for that strike was a veteran captain of the Home Guard who had served under Pied for many years. Ty Auberon could be depended on, and Pied Sanderling was depending on him heavily. The bulk of the army, the elven guards armed with swords and short spears, was gathered about Pied, grouped in makeshift units with newly designated commanders and lieutenants. Because they were formed of remnants of decimated units, few had fought together before. There was a considerable disadvantage in close quarters, where one's life often depended on the experience and quick thinking of those on either side. But most were familiar with the triangle formations Pied had chosen to employ, so the captain of the Home Guard could only hope that in battle the men would remember to do what was needed to keep the units intact and the enemy from breaking through. Pied glanced up and down the lines to either side, checking for readiness. He found it in the faces of most, and he knew that would have to suffice. There was no time left for anything but hope and trust. Alternating the advances of the triangles would give each unit a short respite between strikes, and a rear guard to buttress points threatened with breakthrough. He had decided to hold two units in reserve, keeping them back for when they were needed most. With luck, they would not be needed at all. But he couldn't trust to luck in the face of what was at stake. These were the best of what remained. They were still alive, and they had not fled during the night. They had chosen to stay, to stand with him against an enemy that had already routed them once. That said something to him about their courage. The first wave of the Federation attack force appeared from out of the draw, marching in loose formation, shields up, but swords locked in place in the carry straps behind the shields. Their scouts ranged to either side, but were still well below the ravines and rocks in which the elves hid. Had they chosen to come on ahead, doing what scouts were supposed to do, they would have been disposed of. Pied had no idea what the Federation commanders were thinking. Perhaps that the elves were too disorganized to make a stand. Perhaps that they would do so farther north. Perhaps that they were rallying with reinforcements in Callahorn. Or perhaps they weren't thinking anything. Perhaps they were just moving ahead, surprised themselves that after so many years, the stalemate was broken. Perhaps they were still coming to terms with what that might mean. Pied glanced behind him at the veteran archer he had chosen to give the attack signal. The man's bow was strung, and the whistle arrow notched. Meeting his commander's eye, he nodded that he was ready. Pied took a deep breath. The sounds of the approaching army filled his ears. Their boots stirred the dust from the flats and filled the air with a light haze. Spear blades glinted in the sunlight, and coughs and shouts emptied out the last of dawn's silence. "Patience," he willed himself. His hands closed more tightly about his sword. Another few seconds. He let the first 10 rows of the Federation Army clear the mouth of the draw before he gave the hand signal to the archer at his back. The archer dropped to one knee, drew back his bowstring, and released the signal arrow, its shaft meticulously cored and its tip altered. The arrow caught the wind as it flew and made a shrieking sound that could be heard for hundreds of yards in the silence of the early morning. It was deafening. Instantly, the elven bowmen released their arrows from both sides of the advancing Federation force. A deep whine like the buzzing of 1,000 swarming bees replaced the shriek of the warning arrow, and Pyde's heart lurched. Positioned to fire in 3 alternating waves, his bowmen sent wave after wave of steel-tipped arrows raining down on the unprotected men. Screams and cries rose on the morning air. Dozens of Federation soldiers were dead or injured before they could react. When those remaining realized what was happening, they turned in all directions at once, and dozens more fell. Caught in the open, they had no chance of escaping the assault. Even using armor and shields to ward off the deadly killing shafts, they were vulnerable. No matter where they turned or what they did, some missiles still managed to get through. Finally, someone in the ranks took control, and the remnants of the stricken forward units formed up and charged the archers in the small groups, reinforced by soldiers still coming out of the draw, hundreds of them, flooding the flats with silver and black uniforms.
Elessadil!
Pied Sandaling shouted the elven war cry, leaping from his hiding place and raising his arm. In a solid line, the front ranks of the elven hunters surged from their hiding places behind the rise and charged the Federation command, taking up Pied's war cry. The Southlanders, split apart in their efforts to reach the archers on their flanks, were caught by surprise. To their credit, they swung into defensive formation with practiced smoothness, but their ranks were already decimated, and there were gaps that could not be filled quickly enough. The elves hammered through the front lines to the center, bowling over Federation soldiers who tried to stop them, pushing back the entire command. But the soldiers of the Federation were well trained, and they regrouped quickly, first slowing, then stopping the assault, bracing behind dozens of oncoming ranks, behind weapons and armor, front ranks dropping to one knee and bracing the butts of their spears against the hard pan, rear ranks lowering spears over their shoulders. The elves slammed into the wall, but failed to break it, tried a second time, and failed again. Pyde, still standing on the rise with the bulk of the elfin forces, signaled his archer a second time. A pair of arrows shrieked a command as they arced above the combatants. Not all heard the shrieking sound, but those who did signaled their followers to pull back. Swiftly, the elves disengaged, retreating on the run to the topmost part of the rise, moving past the 6 fighting triangles into which the remainder of the elven foot soldiers had been formed. It took only minutes for the first wave to retreat, but even in that short time, hundreds more Federation soldiers poured through the gap onto the flats, joining their fellows. It was a much larger force than Pyde had envisioned, much larger than his elves were equipped to handle, but there was nothing he could do about that. Lifting his sword a second time, he called out the Elessadil battle cry and sent his triangles into battle. The triangles advanced as one. Shields locked and spears lowered, they presented bristling walls of steel tips. The triangles were formed into 2 lines, 3 triangles of 80 men each in front and 3 behind, the latter offset slightly to the right of the former so that the leading points of each triangle filled all the gaps. As the triangles bore down on the Federation, Eris Kruer had the archers on the slopes rake the enemy soldiers once more, forcing them to cover up with their shields as they scrambled to reform their shattered lines. Federation archers responded with crossbows, but they could not see their targets and were forced to fire blindly. The men of the Federation reformed their ranks once more, but many of those in the front lines had been downed by the initial attack, and the gaps were hastily filled with reinforcements. The result was a reconfiguration of ranks where the soldiers were unfamiliar with each other and slow to act in concert or to a common purpose. It was all they could do to make ready to engage the advancing elves. Their commanders struggled to unify them, but the chaos was so complete that no one could be heard. 50 yards from the Federation lines, the elves shifted hard to the left, drawing the Federation squares about to face them. As the Federation lines turned to face the Freeborn advance, their rear left flank was exposed. Ty Auberon, still hidden in the rocks with his men and waiting for his opportunity, was quick to act. Just before the triangles reached the Federation ranks, he brought his own soldiers out of hiding and attacked in a rush. Once again, the unexpectedness of the assault caught the Federation off guard. Having survived the first ambush, the Southlanders were not looking for a second. Ty Auberon's forces caught their rear ranks unprepared and vulnerable, and they smashed through before the surprised soldiers could even bring their weapons about to defend themselves. Caught in a classic pincer movement, the Federation lines collapsed into pockets of men fighting to survive. The triangles came at them in a series of thrusts, first one rank, and then the second, jabbing at them repeatedly, forcing them back and apart from each other. The Federation defense held only minutes against the elves, then fell apart. The attack turned into a rout. The men in the front lines who tried to flee, piling up against those still coming through the draw, screams and cries filled the air as soldiers fell beneath the crush, trampled. The ground grew cluttered with dead and wounded. The flats turned into a slaughterhouse. The destruction of the Federation force was so complete that it became difficult for the elves to advance across the body-strewn ground. Finally, the surviving Southlanders broke free of the charnel house and began to retreat into the draw, the rear ranks falling back so that those still alive in the front could follow. Most of the latter never made it. The memory of their defeat on the Precandoran was still fresh in the minds of the elven hunters, and they were consumed by a killing lust that would not allow them to stop fighting, even when almost no one was left alive to oppose them. "Signal a retreat!" Pied ordered the archer at his elbow, exchanging a quick glance with Drummond Dune. The archer did so. 3 arrows whistling through the mid-morning air, their shrieks mingling with those of the dead and dying men below. The elven hunters, streaked with blood and wild-eyed with battle fever, fell back reluctantly, leaving behind a tangle of dead men and an earth turned slick and matted with blood. In the shadows of the draw, the last of the retreating Federation soldiers disappeared from view. 30 minutes later, Pied stood at the head of the rise with Ty Auberon and Eris Kruer, watching the details move through the carnage below, extracting the elven dead and wounded. The sun was high in the sky by then, midday approaching, and the air was hot and still and thick with the smell of blood and death. Flies swarmed in black clouds. The men on the rise were making a conscious effort to breathe through their mouths. "It's not finished," he said. "No," Ty Auberon agreed, looking off into the hills as if he might catch sight of the enemy. He was a big man, broad-shouldered and lean, wearing his dark hair long and tied back. "But they will come at us another way." Pied nodded. "They will regroup, reinforce, and come looking for us again, but not through that draw. There are other trails through these hills, tough to navigate, but usable. They will find one and try to get around behind us." "But they won't underestimate us next time," Auberon added. Pied thought about that a moment, then turned to Drummond Dune, who was standing off to one side. "Drum, see if we have someone in the command who knows this country well enough to talk to us about its passes and trails." Eager to be doing something other than standing around trying not to watch the burial teams, Drummond Dune hurried off. Pied would have been happy to go with him.
What about the airship?
Eris Kruer asked quietly. His blocky form shifted.
The one that destroyed the fleet.
Pied shook his head. I don't know how badly we damaged her. If they can make her fly, we're in trouble. We have no defense against her from the ground and little enough from the air. We have to hope they can't use her yet.
They might already be using her against Vaden Wyk and our freeborn allies,
Oberyn growled.
If I was them, that's what I would do. Break us where we still hold, chase us back into the hills, and then hunt us at leisure.
Pied considered the possibility. Oberyn might be right. It made sense to finish the effort to drive the Freeborn completely off the heights, to smash their defenses and claim the Precandoran themselves before worrying about the elves, most of whom were already scattered to the four winds, his command notwithstanding. After all, how much trouble could his little force present in the larger scheme of things? Pied did not fool himself about their chances. They might have won this one battle, driven back one unit of the Federation, but the enemy forces were vast and close to home, where reinforcements were readily available. A sustained Federation effort at finding and engaging his elves would eventually succeed, and when that happened, they were finished. He exhaled softly, frustrated. They couldn't win the war, not with the way things stood. The best they could do was to avoid the forces hunting them long enough to link up with their allies. As their leader, it was up to him to find a way to make that happen. It was a tall order. One he was not sure anyone would be able to carry out, let alone a captain of the Home Guard whose primary duty until 2 days ago had been to safeguard one man. Drummond Dune had reappeared with a smallish, nervous-looking elf with lean features and quick, sharp eyes that darted everywhere. Captain, his aide said, this is Wyle. He has served on the front for more than a year, working as a scout on both sides of the line, much of the time aboard airships. He has seen more of the terrain than most. I think he can help.
Pied nodded.
Tell me what you know about the passes that run through the Precandoran to these hills. Are there many? The elven hunter hunched his shoulders and pursed his thin lips.
Dozens.
How many that a large force could negotiate coming south to north?
3, maybe 4.
The eyes skipped across Pied's face to the faces of his companions and back again.
You think they'll come at us again, Captain?
Maybe. Could they, if they wanted to, do you think? How would they come? Wyle thought about it.
Other than through the draw they just retreated down, they have only one other good choice. There's another cut through the hills to the west. It's wide and flat and open, but it will take them 2 or 3 days to reach it and get through, then come up to where we are.
To the west, Pied repeated, thinking.
Nothing east?
The elf shrugged.
One trail, through scrub, forests, low country, pretty dangerous, lots of bogs and sinkholes, cuts pretty close at its south end to where the dwarves and bordermen hold the East Plateau. It would be risky for them to try it.
For them?
But maybe not for us, Pied thought.
The beginnings of a plan were taking shape. He nodded to Wyle. Your help is appreciated. You may go back to your unit, but keep what we've said to yourself for now. Don't speak of it to anyone. The elven hunter nodded and hurried off across the grass with several anxious glances back. In spite of his promise, he would tell his friends what had been said. In particular, he would tell them that their commander was anticipating another attack, one that might not turn out as well for the elves as this one had. Word would spread quickly. Panic, if not squelched, would as well. Pied turned back to Ty Oberyn and Eris Kruer. Form up the wounded. Everyone who can't fight another battle right away. Detail enough men to carry those who can't walk. Use as few as you can manage, but enough so that they can travel afoot for several days. I want them to make for the Rappahalladrin, then for the villages in the Dalln. They will find wagons there to complete the rest of the journey home. With luck, they will come across an airship to transport them. Form up everyone else and prepare to march. We'll move eastward toward that pass Weil mentioned, the tougher one that leads to the defensive position of our allies. Our best choice now is to try to link up with Vaden Wyk before the enemy finds us again. There's some cover along the way. It may help shield us from Federation airships. Captain, if they send airships after us, whether it's the one with the weapon or not, we won't be able to hide this many men, Eris Kruer pointed out quietly. Pied met his gaze. Get on with it, Lieutenant. I want all burials completed and the wounded dispatched north within the hour. I want the rest of us heading east. Wait. Not all of us. Detail 2 dozen men to stay behind to watch the pass in case the Federation decides to send scouts through to see if we're still here. We don't want them to find out too quickly that we've gone. All we need is a presence to keep them guessing. The men can use the time to create false trails. I want them to hold the pass for 1 day, then catch up to us. Put a tracker or two in the mix, and bring up Weil again as well. We'll need what he knows about the country. When they were gone, he walked over to Drummond Dune. His aide shifted his lanky body from foot to foot. He looked dusty and tired, but he smiled at Pied anyway.
Not much help for some things, is there, Captain?
Drum, I need you to do something, Pied replied, taking the other's arm and steering him away from everyone else.
Word has to be sent to Arborlorn of what's happened. Maybe it's already been done, but we can't know. The Elven High Council has to be told that the king and his sons are dead. More to the point, they have to be told to send reinforcements. More airships, more men to fly them. We don't stand a chance without their support. I want you to do this. Travel on foot until you can find horses, then ride until you can find an airship. Take 2 of the home guard with you, just in case. Leave at once. Drummond Dune looked at him.
Arling will be queen now, he said. It will be her decision.
He was saying that she might not be favorably disposed toward Pied's suggestion, no matter what the High Council said. Nor toward Pied, for that matter, once she learned that he had failed to keep her sons safe. But there was nothing Pied could do about it without speaking to her. He had to hope she would allow him the opportunity, that something of what he believed she had once felt for him would persuade her to do what was right.
Do the best you can, Drum, he said quietly. He placed his hand on the other's shoulder. But do it quickly.
I don't like leaving you, Captain,
his aide replied, shaking his head slowly, looking down at his feet.
I don't like having you leave me, but we don't always get to choose in these matters. I have to send someone I can depend upon to do this. There isn't anyone I depend on more than you.
He thought he saw Drummond Dune actually blush, but it was hard to tell beneath the layers of dirt and sweat. Drum rubbed his fringe of black beard and nodded.
I'll do my best.
He was, as usual, as good as his word. By the time the wounded were loaded on litters and their bearers and caregivers ready to depart, Drum was already gone. Pied found himself wishing he could have given his friend something more than encouragement, but at least he was sending him out of the fighting. Drum was a good man, but he wasn't meant to stand in the front lines on a battlefield.
Maybe I'm not meant for this either, Pied thought. But here I am.
He slung his longbow across his shoulders, cinched his quiver a notch tighter, and went off to meet his fate. Chapter 7. Darkness had settled across the cities of the Southland, but it was nothing compared to the darkness that had found a home in Shadea Aru's heart. She stood at a floor-to-ceiling window in a reception room deep inside Sen Dunsadan's compound, staring out at the lights of Ereshkigal. She had not moved from that spot, had barely changed her position in more than an hour.
She had gone deep inside herself, escaping the disagreeableness of the present, a druid trick she had taught herself early on in her time at Paranor, when she had no friends and no future. It had served her well then. It was less effective now. Behind her, the captain of her gnome hunters stood with two of his men and watched her uneasily. He could feel the heat radiate from her. He felt her anger as she quietly seethed. He did not want to be present when she reached the boiling point, but there was nowhere else for him to go. It had been a long day in more ways than one. They had arrived aboard the Bremen the previous night, only to be told that Sen Dunsadan had not yet returned from the Precandoran, where he was personally overseeing the destruction of the elves. Shadea had been willing to forgive his failure to adhere to their schedule. The defeat of the elves was a major blow to the freeborn hopes, and the Prime Minister would want to make certain things did not go awry. She had heard of the defeat of the elven fleet, of the burning of their airships, and of the deaths of Kellan Elessadil and his young sons. She had heard of the subsequent rout of the elven army and its frantic retreat into the hills north. Sen Dunsadan had accomplished something important. He had done it without her help. She would grant him his victory, even though it rankled her that he had deliberately gone behind her back to achieve it. She had gone to bed in the quarters provided for her, with the expectation that their meeting would take place promptly the next day. She had been wrong. A day of touring the ministries, of speaking before the Coalition Council, and of deliberate delays had left her convinced that something she knew nothing about was happening. She could feel it in the attitude of the ministers with whom she met, men and women who were civil and indulgent, but clearly disdainful of her as well. They extended courtesies because they would do so even to their worst enemy on such a visit, but there was no warmth or sincerity in the efforts. By nightfall, she had lost her patience with Sen Dunsadan entirely. She had been advised of his return several hours earlier, but then he had asked that she wait while he freshened himself for their meeting. She had kept her composure mostly by telling herself that it would only weaken her position with him to reveal the depths of her irritation. If he thought he could undo her so easily, he would be much more difficult to manage. And she already knew from the news of his victory on the Precandoran and the nature of her reception here that he would be difficult in any case. A knock sounded on the door to the reception room, and a functionary cautiously stepped just inside the opening. Shadea came out of her shell instantly, but let him stand where he was for a moment, her eyes directed out the window toward the city. Then, drawing herself up, she turned to face him. "My lady," he said, bowing to her, "the Prime Minister apologizes for the delay and begs your indulgence for just a few minutes more. He is almost ready to receive you and asks that you wait. I have waited long enough," she said quietly, cutting off the rest of what he was about to say. The words were edged in steel so sharp that the functionary winced visibly. He hesitated, then tried to speak again. But Shadea's hand had lifted, her fingers had pointed in his direction, and suddenly his voice had failed completely. He gasped and tried again and again, but nothing would come out. She crossed the room and stood before him. "Captain," she said to the leader of her gnome escort. His hard, weathered face appeared at her elbow. "Ready the Bremen for departure. Take your men with you. I will be along in a few minutes." Her captain of the guard frowned. "It is not safe for you here alone, mistress." "Safer for me than for some," she answered. "Do as I say." He left without further comment, taking his men with him, leaving her alone in the reception room with the still voiceless functionary. "As for you, little man," she said to him, "I have other plans. Do you wish your voice back? The functionary nodded eagerly.
I thought as much.
What service do you think I require of you, if I am to grant you this favor? He did not need to ask. He led her out through the doorway and down the hall. They passed dozens of guards, all armed and at watch, but none tried to stop them. Shadea had drawn her druid robes tight about her, but within their folds, concealed from view, the fingers of her right hand flexed in a series of intricate moves, calling up magic to within easy reach, readying herself for the unexpected. She did not think she would have to use her magic, but she knew enough to be prepared, in case she did. She could not trust Sen Dunsadan, could not rely on him to act honorably toward her, even as a guest of state. One thing she had learned about the Prime Minister of the Federation, he would do whatever he felt was necessary to get what he wanted. The hallway ended at a pair of ornately carved double doors that stood open to the light. The room within was candlelit, but draped in its corners and along its edges by deepest shadow. She heard Sen Dunsadan's voice, smooth and persuasive, a hiss against the silence. A snake's voice, she thought. But she knew how to draw the poison from his fangs. The functionary turned toward her questioningly as they reached the door, uncertain of what he was expected to do next. She solved the problem for him by fastening one hand about his neck and marching him into the room in front of her. Sen Dunsadan was seated on a couch to one side, sipping wine and speaking with a shadowy figure seated in the corner of the room where it was darkest. Shadea did a quick search of the chamber, found only the two and no one else present, swept up to Sen Dunsadan in a rush of black robes, and threw his functionary at his feet.
"Ready to receive me now, Prime Minister?" she asked softly.
She eyed the glass of wine he held poised midway to drinking and smiled.
"Go ahead. Finish it."
He did so, watching her carefully, clearly surprised by her appearance, but not altogether unprepared. A man like him was never entirely unprepared. She gestured at the functionary, who coughed out a few startled words, climbed quickly to his feet, and ran from the room.
"I was just about to come for you," Sen Dunsadan said,
putting down the glass of wine and rising,
"but I wanted to make certain of what I would say before we met."
"You have had time enough to make certain of what you will say for the next year. What seems to be the problem? Are you at a loss for words? Do you find your oratorical skills have suddenly deserted you?"
She paused.
"Or are you simply worried about how I might perceive your duplicity in acting without my knowledge in the matter of the Brecken Doran?"
The Prime Minister's face darkened.
"I do not need to apologize for that.
I acted when the opportunity presented itself, just as you would have done in my place. Had I waited to consult with you, the opportunity would have been forever lost. Don't presume to lecture me on how to conduct myself as leader of the Federation. I do what I must."
"Yes," she acknowledged. "And you tell me of it in your own good time, it seems. I do not judge you for your decision in attacking the Freeborn. I judge you for your failure to inform me of it. It smacks of an independence that verges on rebellion. Have we come to a point where you think you no longer have need of an alliance with me, or with the Druid Order? Does your success whisper to you that you are sufficiently strong that you need ally yourself with no one? Is that the course you have chosen?"
She turned toward the shadowy figure in the corner.
"Or do you take your counsel from someone else these days? Someone you think may advise you better?"
There was a long silence. Then the figure in the corner rose, a slow, languid movement of limbs and torso. He seeks the counsel of someone who has his best interests at heart. Shadea. Iridia. She breathed the name like a curse. Iridia Illyri, or at least a pale imitation of the elfin sorceress, stepped into the light. Whatever Shadea might have thought she would find, it wasn't this. There was no reason for Iridia to be present, not as an ally to Sen Dunsedain, not as a creature in thrall to the Prime Minister of the Federation. Even more shocking was how her one-time ally looked. Bloodless and drained of life, thin to the point of emaciation, and hard-eyed in a way she had never seemed before. There was something wrong with her, but Shadea could not decide what it was. "Did you think you had seen the last of me?" Iridia asked, her voice as bloodless as her face. "Did you think me safely away from Paranor and your druid schemes?" Shadea stared, not knowing what she thought, except that it wasn't this. "You drove me from Paranor," Iridia continued in her flat, lifeless monotone. "You refused me any chance to gain revenge over the man who had wronged me. You took away my power. You stripped me of my pride. So I came here to give my services to one who would better appreciate them." Shadea looked back at Sen Dunsedain. He shrugged.
"She acts as my personal advisor now. Her help has been invaluable to me. I hope you don't intend to try to rob me of it out of jealousy or a misguided sense of prior claims."
She grimaced. "Please, Prime Minister, try not to sound as stupid as you act. I don't care whom you bring into your confidence. Even her. She speaks the truth. She was banished when she failed to live up to her pledge to serve the Order. She would not be welcomed back now even if she sought to return voluntarily. I certainly have no intention of trying to make her return by force. But you might think about her failure to serve one master and ask yourself how likely it is that she will successfully serve another."
"I think I'm the best judge of how well a person will serve me, Shadea," Sen Dunsedain shrugged. "After all, I was smart enough to ally myself with you, wasn't I?"
"An alliance that no longer seems to have much merit, given what I see of your present situation." The Prime Minister moved over to his couch and sat down again, his earnest expression only barely concealing the satisfaction she was certain he was feeling at her discomfort. She would have liked to wipe it away with her fingernails, but she wanted to see where things were going first.
"Our alliance still has value," he said, motioning for her to sit. She remained where she was. "As I said, I acted as I did on the Precandoran because the opportunity presented itself. But the war is not over, and I still have need of your support, and the support of the Druid Order. If I am to successfully conclude the war with the Freeborn, I must press north and west to force a resolution. I cannot do this without at least the tacit support of the Druids. By the same token, I know that you need my support as well. You lack any other alliances. The dwarves, the elves, the trolls, and the bordermen all refuse to give you the allegiance you seek. They have not yet accepted you as Ard Rhys. For that matter, some within your own order have not accepted you."
She said nothing, holding her temper, showing nothing of what she was feeling. When the time was right, she would squash him like a bug. Assuming Iridia let him live that long. Shadea was convinced that the sorceress was making use of him for her own needs and would keep him around only so long as was necessary.
"I don't say that you won't find a way to deal with these troublemakers, Shadea," the Prime Minister continued. But you must agree that it will make things considerably easier for you if we maintain our alliance rather than cast it aside. And, of course, it will make things easier for me as well. Especially if your armies suffer another defeat like the one they suffered in the passes north of the Precandoran 2 days ago. She smiled.
How many men did you lose? More than 1,000?
At the hands of some ragtag elven castoffs you had driven from the heights? She enjoyed the look of surprise that appeared on his face, a look he tried without success to conceal. He had not expected her to know of the army's defeat, a secret he had tried hard to conceal from everyone. But there were no secrets that he could conceal from her.
You had them beaten, Sendancedon. You had them scattered and disheartened, and you let them drive your pursuit force into the ground. In all the years I served in the Federation Army, I never heard of such stupidity. How could you let something like that happen?
Enough, Shadea. You have had your fun with me. Now let it alone. I intend to rectify matters on the Precandoran within a few days. When I am finished, the entire Freeborn army will be in tatters, and my armies will be deep within their homelands.
If I decide to let you do so.
She kept Sendancedon's eyes locked on her own, chained by the steel of her gaze.
I am not certain now that I should.
She saw the rage in those eyes, his hatred for her burning in them. She did not look away. The silence between them lengthened.
You presume a great deal, Shadea,
Iridia Ileri said suddenly.
Her voice was as cold as winter midnight and empty of feeling. Shadea was taken aback in spite of herself.
Something about Iridia Leary was not right. Something about her was changed, something deep and abiding, invisible to the eye, but there all the same.
She broke eye contact with Sendancedon and glanced over.
It worries me that I may have allied myself and my order's cause with fools. I will presume what I must to remedy such a mistake.
She studied Iridia a moment longer, then turned back to Sendancedon.
Tell me, Prime Minister, must I do so here?
Sendancedon sighed.
I don't want you for an enemy, Shadea. You must know that.
I need the Druid Order to give its blessing to my efforts.
I need to know you will not interfere with my plans. Surely you can see this.
Shadea walked over to the wine pitcher, poured herself a glass and drank, deeply. She watched Iridia casually as she did so, trying to read something of what it was about her that was so troubling. It was in her eyes, she thought. It was in the way she looked out at the world.
The problem was there. You need me,
she said. But not enough to tell me of your plans until after they are executed. I have kept nothing back from you that you couldn't find out on your own, it seems.
Your attack on the elven fleet, your destruction of their army, your own army's subsequent setback, your alliance with Iridia, what other secrets do you keep from me?
He sighed. What secrets do you think I keep, Shadea?
I haven't heard any mention of your new weapon, the one that so effectively destroyed the elven fleet. An oversight?
The Prime Minister shrugged.
It is a fire launcher, a pressure feed that sends burning liquid from a nozzle mounted on our airships into others, setting them aflame. A conventional weapon, good over short distances when properly manned, it is hardly worth mentioning.
What a pathetic liar,
Shadea thought.
Which must be why you failed to mention it. Or is there something about it I might find objectionable?
A forbidden use of magic, perhaps?
Magic, Sendancedon laughed. Where would I get magic?
Oh, you think Iridia might have given me something from the druid storehouse, do you?
Wouldn't that be useful?
But no. The weapon was developed long before Iridia appeared with her offer of support. She brings nothing of her druid lore or of druid magic to our relationship. Nothing that isn't her own, anyway. There is no betrayal of the druids involved in the building of this weapon, Shadea. What are you worried about? The power of the druids is more than a match for anything I have at my command. I have only my armies and my airships.
It was difficult to judge how deep the lie went. But it went sufficiently deep that Shadea was certain the weapon was much more powerful than he was suggesting, and that he intended it for more than simple warfare. At some point, he would seek to use it against the druids, because in his heart, he could never be at rest until he had destroyed everyone who might threaten him. That was the demon that had driven him since he had begun his ascent to power all those years ago. It was a demon with which she had a fair amount of personal experience. "Your plan," she said, "is to use this weapon against the remaining freeborn ground forces on the Precandoran? On the dwarves and bordermen?" He nodded.
"And on the remnants of the elves who ambushed my pursuit force.
The freeborn have nothing with which to combat it. The best they have been able to do is damage the airship that transports it,
and that was a fluke."
He sipped at his wine.
"The war on the Precandoran is over, Shadea. The moment my airship returns to the skies, all I require to proceed is your clear support for my efforts.
For the Federation's efforts," he corrected.
She walked over to the window, brushing past Iridia Illyri as if she weren't there. But feeling something so dark and empty as she did so, that she wished she had avoided the sorceress entirely. Pausing at the window, she shuddered a moment in spite of herself. Whatever had happened to Iridia wasn't anything for the better. She looked out at the city, considering her options, giving herself sufficient space and time to choose wisely. She made several decisions in that moment, but she spoke only of one. She turned back to Sendunsadan. "The Druid Order will support your efforts, Prime Minister. I will announce that support on my return to Paranor. But there are two conditions.
First, you will speak before the Coalition Council tomorrow in support of my ascendancy to the position of Ard Rhys. You will make your support complete and unequivocal. No half-measures, no politicians' word games. Second, you will fly to Paranor within the week to speak before the Druid Order so that all may hear your justification for the invasion of the other lands. You are good at explanations, Sendunsadan. You should be able to come up with one."
The Federation leader studied her, thinking through the ramifications of accepting her offer, as she knew he would. Then nodded.
"Agreed."
She walked back across the room, her eyes never leaving his, coming to a stop when she reached him. "A final word. Do not even think about trying to use your new weapon against me. Your hunger for power is vast, Sendunsadan, so I know the thought has crossed your mind. Control the druids and you control the four lands. But you lack the skill and the experience to manage such a task, even with your new ally to advise you." She glanced at Iridia. "She is good at what she does, and once she was great. But she is only one person, and nowhere near strong enough to challenge me. So keep a tight rein on your ambitions, and do not forget your place in the pecking order. The druids wield the real power in the four lands, just as they always have." She looked back at him, waiting for his response.
"I won't forget," he said quietly. "I won't forget anything."
He was making a thinly veiled threat, but she would allow that. A threat was only words until it was backed up by something more substantial than anything Sendunsadan could command. She moved close to him, placing herself squarely between Iridia and himself.
"Watch your back, Saint Dunsadan," she whispered.
Then she strode from the room without looking at either of them again, and made her way through the halls of the compound building to board her airship and fly home.
"She is too dangerous," Saint Dunsadan declared, once she was gone.
He faced Iridia Illyrian challenge.
"Too dangerous for either of us. You would not argue the point, would you?"
She floated across the room, into the darkness from which she had come, and sat down again, cloaked in shadows.
"I wouldn't worry about Shadea Aru, Saint Dunsadan."
He didn't care for the way she said it.
"Well, I do worry about her, Iridia. If you choose to pretend she isn't a threat, that is up to you. But I intend to do something about her."
"I can protect you," she said.
"Perhaps. But if Shadea is dead, I won't need your protection."
There was a long silence.
"Killing her won't be easy," she said. "And if you fail, she will know who to come looking for. Besides, who will you send to eliminate her? Who can you trust to make certain she is dead?"
He hesitated, unable to answer those questions.
"And we have other concerns at the moment." Iridia sounded sleepy and bored. "Your airship is nearly ready to fly again. You need to do what I told you. You need to take it into the Westland and attack the elven home city of Arbalon. You need to convince the elves they are not safe anywhere, so that they will agree to abandon their alliance with the Freeborn."
"If I smash the Freeborn army first, I won't need to worry about persuading the elves to abandon their alliance. There won't be anyone left for them to ally themselves with."
"An ill-advised course of action."
He felt displeasure radiating from her words.
"A waste of time and effort. You might smash this army, but they will simply raise another. You think too small, Saint Dunsadan. You must think in larger terms. Winning the war on the Precandoran will not happen until you win the war in their homes. Strike at their capital cities, and they will seek your peace quickly enough. Start with Arbalon, then fly on to the others. Soon, all resistance will end."
Her argument made sense, as it had the first time she had made it, but something about it bothered him. It felt to him as if she was saying one thing, but meaning another, as if she had thought the situation through better than he had and knew something about it he didn't. Besides, he could not ignore the defeat he had suffered in the borderlands at the hands of the elves. His army, so certain of victory after the destruction of the elven air fleet, was stunned by the abrupt turnabout. He could not ignore what that meant to morale. If he didn't give the army a fresh reason to believe that the war was ending, it was hard to say what might happen.
"The best approach is still the one I settled on originally, Iridia. We attack the Freeborn position on the east plateau of the Precandoran, using the airship and her weapon to break their defensive lines. Once they are scattered and the position overrun, the Federation will hold the entire Precandoran. Then I will do as you suggest, and fly the Dectera to Arbalon and attack the elven home city."
She said nothing. She stared at him from out of the darkness, an all but invisible presence, faceless and silent. He waited for her to speak, but she didn't. Finally, he lost patience and rose.
"I am going to bed. We can talk about this later. Think about what we can do to eliminate Shadea. I won't sleep soundly again until she's disposed of."
He walked quickly from the room, the weight of Iridia Illyri's eyes pressing against his exposed back. Chapter 8. A sudden lurch of the airship brought Kyber Elesidil awake, jarring her from sleep with such abruptness that for a moment she did not know where she was. Then her scattered thoughts came together, and she remembered. She was hiding in a locker in a forward storeroom that was filled with yards of light sheaths and coils of radiant draws and heavy rigging. Rough voices sounded from somewhere outside the locker, and she flinched anew. Gnome guards. She blinked uncertainly, listening as the voices drew nearer and the storeroom door banged open. She caught her breath as the gnomes rummaged about, conversed in their guttural tongue, then departed once more. She took a deep, steadying breath, squeezed free of the sail material into which she had wrapped herself, then opened the locker door cautiously and peered out. Shadows draped the storeroom in heavy layers, the darkness broken by slender bands of moonlight spearing through cracks in the shutters that closed off the storeroom's solitary window. Reluctant to chance another encounter that might end less favorably, she had been hiding there since she had been discovered and almost caught the previous night. If she was discovered, she knew Penn would have no chance at all. Not that he had much anyway. After watching the flare of magic explode from the hold of the Athabasca the previous night, she feared the worst had happened already. She slipped from the locker and moved over to the shuttered opening, peering through its cracks into the night. The airship had landed inside a courtyard ringed by high walls and stark battlements interspersed with watchtowers. To one side, huge buildings rose against the moonlit sky like the squared-off sides of cliffs. They had landed and were inside Paranor. She glanced across the courtyard for the other airships, but at first saw only dark figures scurrying about the landing site, securing lines and fastening anchors. Lights appeared suddenly in windows in the buildings that formed the bulk of the keep, and she heard locks release and a door open. Voices drifted on the night air, whispery and muffled. She needed to get out of the storeroom to find out what was going on, but she knew it was still too dangerous to do so. Her patience ebbing swiftly, she forced herself to wait as the gnome crew went about its business and finally disappeared altogether, save for a watch that patrolled the yard. That she knew because a gnome hunter strolled by the shuttered window, thick-set and armed with a spear and short sword. There would be more stationed close by. Anchored farther down the length of the yard were other airships, their dark shapes barely identifiable in the shadow of the walls. Within the keep, the lights remained aglow, bright squares framed by the windows through which they shone. She wondered how late it was, whether it was past midnight or not, whether it was approaching morning. She glanced at the sky, but could not tell from the position of the stars she could see. When sufficient time had passed and her patience was exhausted, she opened the storeroom door and stepped out into the companionway. She stood listening for a long time, making certain she was alone. Satisfied at last that she was, she moved down the passageway and climbed on deck. Crouched in the shelter of the pilot box, just beyond the hatchway, she peered around the airship decking, then beyond to the courtyard. The Athabasca was anchored right next to her own ship, and the third ship was anchored just a little farther away. All appeared deserted. But on the ground below, gnome hunters patrolled, slow-moving shadows in the night. Kyber considered her situation. She could not get off the airship without alerting the watch, yet she had to reach Penn. She assumed he had been taken inside the keep, but could not know that for a fact without checking the Athabasca first. That would take time, however, time she felt she didn't have. She studied the night sky, the position of the stars and moon, reading the time. It was after midnight and getting toward morning. The druids would be asleep, but that would all change when it grew light. Any help she could offer Penn had to come soon. But how could she reach him when she hadn't the faintest idea where he was? She had never been to Paranor, Her time with Aaron was spent entirely in Emberon, his place of exile. He had deliberately chosen to stay away from the Druid's Keep and its politics. Since she had begun her studies with him, he had not gone back even once, and so she had never gone either. It was something she had always meant to do, something she had assured herself would eventually happen. Well, it had, but the circumstances were not what she would have hoped for. She knew a little of the Keep's layout, having asked Aaron about it on several occasions, even persuading him once to draw her a rough map. But in truth, she remembered little of the detail, and it was different being there, staring at its walls and buildings with no idea where to begin her search. She would need someone to help her find her way around, but she could not afford to ask for assistance because that would mean giving herself away. The impossibility of her situation quickly became apparent. On starting out, she had thought that it would be easier, that a way to get to Penn would present itself. She had been wrong, and the boy was likely to pay the price for her presumption. She shivered in response to her dark thoughts, and as her hands rubbed her arms and body to warm herself, they brushed against the small bulk of the elf stones in her pocket. She froze, her fingers closing over the talismans. She had forgotten about the elf stones. Fresh hope warmed her chilly thoughts. She could use their magic to find Penn. The stones would lead her straight to him. And lead the druids straight to her. Her hopes faded. Using the elf stones would give her away instantly. Every druid in the keep was familiar with elven magic. She would be detected in a heartbeat. She released her grip on the stones reluctantly and sank back against the pilot house wall. The use of small magics was commonplace within the druid's keep. Small magics would not be noticed. But the elf stones were a large magic that no one could mistake for anything other than what it was. Nothing could disguise the extent of their power. Another way would have to be found. Another way, she thought, that utilized her skills and training as an apprentice druid, a way that relied upon the lessons she had been taught by her mentor and best friend.